Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is 89.7 FM, KFJC, Los Altos Hills, and another special edition of Thoughtline. My name is Ken Patterson, and I'll be your host this evening as we present a series of different stories produced by the members of the staff here at KFJC. We rerun a Hacker's News interview with Ryan Drummond, actor and video game voice artist who's part of the recently released game Star Wars: The Old Republic. Jocelyn Dong presents us with a plastic brick of a piece as she takes us to the annual Lego show in Palo Alto. And we revisit Mark Laubach's first installment of his series on volunteer emergency communications. But first, we start with Kevin O'Dante as he takes us on a hike in San Mateo County. Here for you on KFJC's Thoughtline.
Then swing along to a hiking song on the highway winding west, tramping highland glens and bracken.
This is Kevin O'Dante with a hike of the week. One thing I often hear is people saying, I'd like to hike more, but I can never find the time. Okay, this can be a cop-out, but it's often a valid excuse, especially at this time of year. What with limited daylight, long hours at work, final exams, Christmas shopping, and other obligations. The only thing is, you really don't need that much time. There are a number of places that are a short drive away where you can fit in a great short hike in a morning, an afternoon, or even a long lunch break. Pulgas Ridge Open Space Preserve is located just off Highway 280 in San Mateo County. A new staging area can be reached by taking the Edgewood Road exit northeast, turning left onto Crestview Drive, and then taking another sharp left turn onto Edmonds Road. It's a fairly small park, popular with local dog owners, but it offers a quick and easy escape from suburbia for the hiker. You begin a very nice loop by heading up the Blue Oak and the Dick Bishop trails, rising fairly quickly through oak woodlands for a good aerobic workout. You then turn left onto the paved Hassler Trail, which takes you near the popular vista point off 280, which is separated from the park by a fence. The heart of this hike is when you head from there onto the Dusky-Footed Woodrat Trail. No, I didn't make that name up. It's a dirt trail that heads farther up into chaparral country and provides great views of the South Bay and nearby hillsides. There's not much shade here, so the coming months are the best time for a visit. The trail eventually descends into a wooded area where bridges cross Cordilleras Creek. Depending on which route you take back, the whole hike covers about 4 to 6 miles and can easily be done in 2 or 3 hours, an amazingly short time considering the scenic diversity you'll experience. If you're hungry for more and have the time, it's a short walk down the road to Edgewood Park, a large preserve famed for its wildflower displays in springtime. But that's another subject for a future hike of the week. There is no fee for parking at Pulgas Ridge Open Space Preserve, which is open during daylight hours. Please note that bicycles and horses are not allowed on the trails. For more information and a map, check out www.openspace.org. Give yourself a memorable present during these busy festive times by spending just a little time at Pulgas Ridge. For the KFJC Public Affairs Department, this is Kevin O'Dante.
Thank you, Kevin. You can hear Kevin O'Dante on KFJC's Sports Middle every Wednesday evening from 6 to 7. Up next, Jocelyn Dong builds us a great little story, brick by brick, as she takes us to the annual Lego exhibition in Palo Alto. Here for you on KFJC's Thoughtline.
There's a lot to see at the annual Holiday Lego Show in Palo Alto. Oh, wow. There's a soaring cathedral, aliens from outer space, downtown street scenes, an amusement park ride, and even a replica World War II Japanese battleship. All made out of the classic gray, black, red, and even pink plastic bricks. Mark Benz is president of the Bay Area Lego Users Group, which has organized the Living Legacy exhibit. He recently spoke with KFJC about the fascination of the enduring childhood toy.
I think it's the ability to create things either that you out of your own imagination or of, you know, models of buildings or what have you that you've seen around, but school buses or cars or trains or airplanes or the Taj Mahal or whatever. I think that the ability to create and destroy the Lego and build something new is like one of its big advantages, okay, and why it's so compelling.
Pence himself enjoys making creations based on real life, whether the California Zephyr train or local landmarks.
Several years ago, I started building several San Francisco scenes. There's a Yearly Square, the Palace of Fine Arts, the Maritime Museum. I think my favorite one of that is the Conservatory of Flowers, and it was actually here. It was only shown once, and it's about this big, or about 3 feet by 2 feet, and all clear Lego pieces in the curvature and with the white filigree that you see at the building in San Francisco.
Now, it's one thing to make a building and display it on your coffee table at home. It's another thing altogether to create an entire world that fills a room the size of a 3-car garage. That's what the Lego club members have done, from farmland to canyon to airport, complete with electric trains running through the landscape.
The interesting thing about the club is that the club owns the tables and the base plates and most of the train track, but everything else that's on the display, on the layout itself and around the outside, are all owned by different individual members. So somebody owns this building, somebody else owns the building, I own the train, somebody else owns the church, somebody else owns the skyscraper or the helicopter or the airplane it's flying or the windmill or the hill or all the buildings are owned by different people. And then we all come together and put the display together every year. This is our 8th year here at the museum.
Perhaps many people don't know that Lego makes train sets, but the Danish company has, almost since it first came out with the small plastic bricks.
Actually, Lego's been making trains since about 1965. They started out with push trains and then went to battery-powered trains in the late 60s, then converted those over to 12-volt trains with a third rail in the middle, and then more recently have the standardized track you see here, which is also electrical and is 9-volt powered. The more recent trains that they have available are back to the battery powered with the same size track.
Humor is a big part of the Lego exhibit, but you have to pay careful attention to catch some of the jokes.
You'll see lots of little touches of detail and humor throughout the display. We have a Tron motorcycle that's caused another car to crash there in the downtown street area. There's the suburban area, the end of the monorail track, and the kind of the hill that divides the suburban area from the farming section. Again, you'll see some more humor there with a tree falling down on a motorcyclist.
Benz points to a lumberjack who has unwittingly felled a tree on top of a motorcycle. And then there are other touches. Over in the farm, camels and ostriches make their home along with the goats and cows. An alien has carved out a crop circle. On the other side of the room, a protest march, unlike the real Occupy movement, includes Darth Vader, a Viking, and a stormtrooper. Throughout the display, tiny Wall-E robots pop up in unlikely places. It's these kinds of details, and the fun expressed in Lego pieces, that keep kids and adults coming to the show year after year. Several years ago, the exhibit drew 10,000 visitors, with the waiting line stretching down the block. Last year, after the group started charging a $2 admission fee, visitors numbered about 6,000. Ben said that was a more manageable crowd. For a toy that's been part of people's childhoods for more than 50 years, Lego has seen its share of changes. To capitalize on the popularity of movies and trends, the company produced themed Lego kits with specialized parts, such as Harry Potter, Star Wars, and action figures called Bionicles. It's not the same brick-based play some of us remember.
There's a combination of the specialty parts that you're talking about and what they call juniorization, where they would take several parts that used to be 3 or 4 individual discrete parts, and they've merged them together into one. So it's easier to build, but at the same time, you lose a lot of the interchangeability and creativity that's involved with that.
To illustrate his point, Benz points to a piece on the cathedral that looks like an upside-down step. It's one piece now, but in the olden days, a child would have had to put together 3 pieces to make the same thing. Over the years, Lego has tried to attract more girls. It's currently introducing a line called Lego Friends. That includes new girl characters and scenes like an animal hospital, a cafe, and an inventor's workshop. It's also producing new colors for bricks, including teal and lavender.
So Lego's had several attempts at creating product lines that are popular or desired by young girls, and they've had varying degrees of success doing that. probably not as much as they'd like. So I think that I've heard that they'll be coming out with some more girl-oriented sets, more for socializing, as well as the traditional pink bricks, houses, that kind of thing. My daughter, for example, likes to build kind of the farm kind of things. She's into horses, so that we have a stable set that she's built.
The Bay Area Lego Users Group reflects that demographic split, with about 70% of its members being male. All told, the group has about 150 members, half of them children, Ben says. It holds monthly meetings in Palo Alto and the East Bay, so members can share ideas, show off creations, and compete in friendly building contests. The Living Legacy exhibit is open Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays through January 15th at the Museum of American Heritage, 351 Homer Avenue in Palo Alto. It will be closed New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, however. Information is available at baylug.org. That's baylug.org. For KFJC Public Affairs, this is Jocelyn Dong.
Thank you, Jocelyn. Besides the LEGO exhibit going on through January 15th, the Museum of American Heritage has other exhibits currently on display. For more information, the Museum of American Heritage's website is www.moah.org. Up next is the first in the series of stories by our own Mark Laubach on the Volunteer Emergency Communications Network in Santa Clara County. Here for you on KFJC's Thoughtline.
This is Mark Laubach for KFJC Public Affairs. I'm here today in the Santa Clara County Emergency Operations Center with Larry Carr. This is the first in a series of programs on emergency communications and volunteers in Santa Clara County. So I thought I'd start at the top of the volunteer emergency communications ladder, if you will, which is in the county, and talk about items that are of particular interest, and also what's changed in the volunteer, I'll call it what we're asking volunteers to do over the last two decades. But we're sitting here in an EOC, and Larry, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Larry Carr. I'm the Chief Radio Officer for the Santa Clara County Office of Emergency Services. As a volunteer, I coordinate volunteers. The primary program that we have within our effort is the so-called Aries RACES Amateur Radio Volunteer Communications Program. I can explain the acronym, but I think that at the moment I would say our job is to add communications capability to the Office of Emergency Services and the Emergency Operations Center. In particular, we can act as a link between the EOC, or the Emergency Operations Center, and the outside world. We link the cities to the county. We also link individual hams to the county, and in particular during things or events such as earthquakes, we can do very rapid surveys countywide of the impact of an earthquake. In particular, we are able to capture damage assessments of the complete county in less than 10 minutes. This has become a major tool for the planning section of the emergency operations programs here. We offer the ability to add to gather information in ways that are outside the normal information collecting structure within emergency operations.
Yeah, one of the leading questions I had, because I am an amateur radio operator myself, in fact, I participate in your activities, but what's changed in the past 20 years?
There's been a major change in the perceived danger when they respond during an emergency. During the Lexington fire, for instance, ham radio operators would walk up to the California Department of Forestry people, and the forestry person would say, "Get in the car, I need you to do communications." It was after the end of that event that it was recognized that there was an enormous potential danger to the responder who's going off to a fire line. And so the state established the disaster service worker program at that point. This has meant that in order to respond as a volunteer during an emergency, you have to register as a state disaster service worker. This gives you workman's compensation as an unpaid professional employee of the agency that uses or activates you. It has meant, though, also that we try very hard to make sure our responders are well trained in not only safety and operational procedures, but in communications capabilities and as well in how to recognize dangers and stay out of trouble.
Let's talk a little bit more about that training. New ham gets his license. Is he ready yet?
No, I think it's something we have working very hard to educate new hams. One of the challenges now is that to become a ham radio operator is quite simple. To get a ham radio license is a one-day event in many cases. It means that you can indeed legally use the radio, but in many of ham's cases, they have not ever even owned a radio. To be able to bridge that gap during an emergency, we need to have these people actually learn how to use their radio effectively, learn how to operate in a group of people that are trained so that they are not intimidated by interaction with this group. That requires training. We have a very comprehensive training program available to anybody who wants to come to the classes. These classes occur once a month. They're given locally, and they are, I am often told how effective they are.
Let's talk a little bit also. The county does training for hams, but doesn't each city also do training?
Yes, I think the key that we operate in our county is I think, the best arrangement that can be made for use of volunteers, in that we have a county-level program called the Mutual Aid Communicator Program that is built on a structure where each of the cities in the county has developed its own Aries Racis communications team. And the training at the city level is often a fundamental structure that we can build on at the county level. The Mutual Aid Communicator Program, as an example, is a procedure that looks to the cities to tell us at the county which of their volunteers are sufficiently trained, sufficiently educated, sufficiently mature to actually perform well in other cities. And we use those personnel to become part of our county-wide support.
Yeah, the interesting thing about communications here is I remind people we are in an active EOC that's currently not activated itself at the moment, but the phones are still here.
Yes.
If we had the 60 people in the room here, we wouldn't even be able to talk like this. There's this term we have in the volunteer world from looking from the trained side to the untrained side that I want you to comment on a little bit if you can, and the term is SUV.
Spontaneous Unaffiliated Volunteer. That is everyone else who has never been involved or thought about being involved in helping until an event occurs. The classic example is a major earthquake when, after the ground has stopped shaking, everybody says, "I want to help. I don't know how I can be used. I don't know if I have a capability that you might want to use, but I want to help." That becomes a major challenge because in order to use a person as an effective tool, this person we need to know a lot about the person, and the person needs to have some experience about how to operate and take care of themselves in an emergency. It's very easy to venture out and say you're going to help. It's also very easy to make yourself part of the problem rather than part of the solution.
If you wanted to appeal to people out there to think about getting involved in some fashion, is there a way you'd like to phrase that?
I would strongly urge all ham radio operators, new or experienced, to start with our website, start becoming exposed to what we do during emergencies. If you're an experienced ham, come to our class on field responder. Learn what we would have you do during an emergency. If you're a really new ham, come to the same class, because that would give you an insight to what you need to study or what you would want to work on to become an effective communicator. For those who are not as interested in ham radio but would like to be able to help out during an emergency, I would then have you start looking into what you might be able to do as telephone communications tasks, secretarial tasks, runner or information transmission personnel, operation of fax machines, Xerox machines, television support personnel, radio support personnel. We have a really significant need to organize each of those areas into viable structure. And the answer for now is call or contact me.
This has been portions of a pre-recorded interview with Larry Carr, Chief Radio Officer for the Santa Clara County Office of Emergency Services. For information on becoming a communications volunteer, contact Larry at lwcarr@alum.mit.edu. For information on Santa Clara County Aries Races, please go to www.sec-aries, that's Aries-races, RACES.org. For KFJC Public Affairs, this is Mark Laubach.
Thank you, Mark. And stay tuned to future editions of ThoughtLine for further reports from Mark Laubach on Santa Clara County's Volunteer Emergency Communications Network. This past summer, we ran the Hackers News interview with the voice of Sonic the Hedgehog, Ryan Drummond. Not only does he talk about Sonic, but he also teased us about the now finally released Star Wars video game, The Old Republic. So we're pleased to present to you an encore edition of the Hackers News with our very own Hackers Muse on KFJC's ThoughtLine.
Welcome to Hacker News. I'm your host, Hackers Muse, your source for the latest releases in science and technology from the Bay Area, California. Let's face it, all of us are players. Whether you log in through a computer, battle via console, or slingshot birds on your mobile phone, video games are everywhere. Now, we usually hear news about the video part for new games, such as the latest in animation technology. But what about the voices we hear in video games? The humans bringing life and personality to computer-generated characters. Well, I had a chance to sit down and talk, in person, with one of those video game voices, actor Ryan Drummond. Drummond was the original English game voice of Sonic the Hedgehog for Sega, a role he played for over 5 years. He has also lent his voice to Guitar Hero, and more recently did recordings at LucasArts for the highly anticipated Star Wars The Old Republic, aka Tor. While on location, he actually got some inside information about the complexity of Tor's development. More on that in just a bit. But first, how did actor Ryan Drummond land the role of Sonic the Hedgehog? He recounts his experience at the original audition, a gathering of just 30 people at a small studio.
Really, at that time, I didn't even really know kind of how big of a deal it was going to be. It was kind of just another audition. Occasionally, you audition for voiceover things where you are aware of the product or you're aware of the character or you have some sort of pre-knowledge about what the game is or what it's based on. And this was certainly that, but I didn't know it was going to be kind of a big deal. I just kind of went to the audition and actually wasn't very well attended because it was, of course, invite only through, people who knew people. It was just kind of like this little group of people that were invited to come read for this. And it was just at a real simple studio in San Diego, California. And they had a picture of Sonic up on the wall inside the recording booth. And it was the direction was really simple. The guy just said, you know, we have this new Sonic game coming out. If you look at this picture of Sonic, and if you can imagine a voice coming out of this character, what would it sound like? They didn't really have a benchmark at that point or an example to show. They didn't even know what they wanted to hear. And so it's just kind of one of those, I don't want to be cheesy and say classic actory moments, but it was just kind of like I looked at the picture. They told me a little bit about how old Sonic was. I obviously knew he had a lot of energy. He's got a lot of quickness to him. And that was the voice that just kind of came out very first try. I didn't run through it in the lobby. I didn't do anything. I just looked at the picture. I saw the line. I said the line like I thought the guy in the picture would say it. And they just happened to like it. And then that was kind of it.
The audition itself was a humble beginning, but as we all know now, Sonic the Hedgehog turned out to be quite a big deal. This year marks Sonic's 20th birthday, and the special anniversary game, Sonic Generations, Ryan Drummond may have started out at a simple studio in San Diego for Sonic. But his latest recordings for Star Wars: The Old Republic were on a whole different scale at the LucasArts compound in San Francisco.
I'm on the new Star Wars game, The Old Republic, which apparently has hit a couple snags. But that was a very cool game to work on, simply for the reason alone that I got to go to LucasArts and kind of see that compound, and not just see it from the outside, but actually, you know, be welcomed in. And boy, that place is like a prison. I mean, in a great way, but it's like, you know, you need a guy at the front desk who knows everything about you. Your background check is done to make sure you're not a corporate spy, and then you have to be, you know, escorted everywhere you go. But it's a very beautiful place too. It's very funny. I was checking in there that first morning, and the guy was just like, "Just to let you know, you're not allowed to go anywhere without an escort." And I said, "Of course." And he said, "You're also not allowed to take pictures of anything except the inside of any restroom that you use. You're allowed to take a picture of the inside of the restroom." And you're also allowed to take like something like 3 photos out by the Yoda fountain. And I was like, "There's a Yoda fountain? Awesome! Where's the Yoda fountain?" I never saw it, actually. I never found the Yoda fountain. But that was cool simply because I did a couple characters in that game, and one spoke Huttese, which most people know that. That's the language that Jabba the Hutt speaks and so forth. And then there was a brand new language, and there's a lot of new languages created for this game. I heard 33 new languages created specifically just for this game. I'm not sure if that's a rumor, but that's what I heard. Some fan told me that. But I know that I spoke in one that has never been spake before. And it was kind of random because, again, it was a list of lines. And this time it wasn't in English. It was just all in Huttese or something like that. So they had what's called a scratch track, where the guy who has created the language has actually said all the lines for you. And then they play that in your headphones. So you hear that. And then he says a line, you repeat the line. And then he says a line, and you repeat the line. So it's like you can read it phonetically kind of on the page, but it's kind of easier to hear somebody say it. Otherwise, you're just kind of reading gibberish. But it was really hilarious, if you think about it, because it was 8 hours that day of just going, hearing some guy in my ear going, and then I go, you know, and it was just like aliens talking in Huttese all day, gibberish. I walked out of there thinking I'd gone insane.
Luckily, Ryan Drummond made it out of the LucasArts compound without losing his mind. He unfortunately missed the Yoda fountain while recording for Star Wars: The Old Republic, but learn he did about how massively complex this massively multiplayer online game really is.
I know it's a huge game. I know it's kind of like record-breaking as far as its scope and its volume. I don't think I'm allowed to say any numbers at this point, but like the engineer who I was working with that day was just like, you know, it's funny, I was just at this video game conference, and the keynote speaker, can't say who he was or what game he was referring to, but he was like, you know, this game that I got coming out has this many voice files, and the whole crowd went, wow, that many voice files. And he was sitting in the audience thinking, Star Wars The Old Republic has 3 times that amount, but no one knows it yet. You know, so I know that it's a huge, huge, we're talking hundreds of thousands of sound files just in this game. I mean, if you think 33 languages just for this game, you got to know it's going to be huge. So I have a feeling that maybe it was just a little too huge and it's just not quite ready yet. Needs to, a little more work.
That was Ryan Drummond, the voice of Sonic the Hedgehog. For KFJC Public Affairs, this is Hacker's Muse with Hacker News.